Okay. Welcome, everyone. ECE 581 during the pandemic. Plan for today, we'll talk a little bit, just go over kind of the traditional syllabus, and then we'll have some discussion about how we are going to run the course during this pandemic, where I'll ask for some of your feedback on what you guys would like to do. And then if we make it through all of that, we'll begin with the course introduction, which will carry us through at least mid next week. And that'll just be kind of a high level design example where we start to talk about some of the things that come into play in the course before we dive into any specific theories. We'll do things somewhat quickly with that, but that's just meant to be a motivating example. So I'm not connected here. So course info, if you haven't had a course with me before, I do most of my coordination through the course website. The short URL is here. That's where I will post things like assignments. I will post lecture slides for every class, post recordings of the lecture for every class. So most of the coordination will be done there. This course is called High Frequency Power Electronics. Why is it called High Frequency Power Electronics? Because they told me I need a course name and I need it today, and that was the first thing that popped into my head. We'll talk in detail throughout the course about what that really means. The short answer is that high frequency is never a good thing. You never really want to go to high frequency. Sometimes it's just a necessary evil to get what you want in terms of things like size, efficiency, control bandwidth. So the goal of the course is really to talk about some of the modeling and design techniques that are going to come into play as we push towards a more detailed design of power electronics than what you might have seen in like an ECE 481 or an undergraduate power electronics course. As we start to try to push towards optimization or get higher efficiencies, smaller sizes, what sort of detailed behaviors do we need to analyze with finer integrity than what we would have done in a basic introductory power electronics course. Therefore, the expectation is that you come in having a basic background in microelectronics, undergraduate circuit sequence, and then the equivalent of an introductory power electronics course, EC 481, if you did your undergrad here, something comparable anywhere else. For me, Daniel Castanet, my office is 504. Office hours I tentatively have as Wednesday 3 to 4, Thursday 10 to 11. We'll talk about what office hours are actually going to look like in a moment, but can everybody make one of those? Anybody have classes or other things during both times? Email here, do everything I can to respond as quickly as possible to any emails regarding the course. Email me about anything in 581, please put EC 581 in brackets in the email just so I can filter it out and respond quickly. Course structure, we're going to meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday. General recommendation for grad course, planning to spend about 3 hours outside of class for every 1 hour of lecture. Other than that, grading is going to be 40% homework and lab work. I will have one homework per week, nothing this week. Be due on Fridays unless we talk about it and say otherwise. Midterm, 25%. It'll be somewhere in the middle of the course. I actually left this in from the last time I taught it. So 29th is not any special date. I haven't changed that. Sometime in the middle of the course and then a final at the end of the class. 35%. Assignments are due by the start of lecture. Everything's going to be submitted through Canvas. All exams, homeworks, labs, anything we do in here, it's all going to be submitted through Canvas. And Canvas will be used for nothing else. I just use it for assignment submission and to report your grades back. Everything else will be on the course website or on some other website. General statements about late work. Nothing unless there's a medical emergency, collaboration is encouraged. We'll try to give you methods to do that while maintaining social distancing, and so on. There is no required textbook for the course. We'll reference things from the Fundamentals of Power Electronics book by Erickson and Maksimovich, particularly some of the materials in chapters 19 and 20. But we'll only kind of allude to it, and we won't cover anything in detail out of the textbook, so you don't have to purchase anything. And you should be able to access this through UT libraries if you ever need it, but there will be no readings or assignments out of that book. It's just a good reference to have.
And there is a link for here. There is a 10-day version of the book. The latest version this year, it's released this year.
They did release it?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it come out. Well, second edition nominally. I haven't heard from them on that latest version. MATLAB and Simulink and LTSpice to be used. They're available on computers here. More likely you can go through the RD servers if you want to remote in to access those from anywhere as long as you're on the campus VPN. And then MATLAB, as a student, you should be able to use MATLAB online. If you want to access it without VPNing in, you can just use their online implementation. Like I said, everything will be posted on the course website, and that's the main place to look for information and coordinate briefly. So if you haven't had a course with me before, this is the course website. Get out of the way.
Hi, Dr.
Yeah.
So can I use other simulation software like Simplora?
In general, you can use whatever simulation software you want, but those are the ones I'm going to support. So if you run into trouble in MATLAB, I'll help you debug and figure out how to fix things. If you're using anything else, you're kind of on your own. As long as you get to the answer, that's fine. But those are the ones that I know and I'll support. So course website, the main place for a lot of the coordination is here on the schedule page. Schedule for every lecture, I'll have the lecture topic. Before lecture, I'll post my lecture slides. So if you want to print them out and take notes and go along with me, they'll be here. After lecture, there'll be two more links in this dark gray bar. That'll be my annotated lecture slides with anything I write during lecture and the recording of the Zoom meeting. So those will all be posted there after lecture. As assignments come up, they'll be linked whenever their due date is, and they're due at the start of class on that day, submitted to Canvas. Materials, various things, some of the tools we use, some tutorials and other instructions on simulation software, MATLAB and Simulink. I'll post various additional references in there as we go along. Assignments, we'll have all of the homework and exams. And again, they're submitted through Canvas. And then the syllabus page is there as well. In our current situation, I've added this online link, which just has the tools we'll use in the class. So Slack, is everybody a member of the current Slack at this point? A couple knows. So I'll just email out to the class how to sign up for that. As long as you use your UTK email address, you can sign up at any time. And then after class, I've made a channel just for EC581. I'll add all of you to that. I haven't talked to them yet, but I'm also going to try to rope some other graduate students who've already taken it into just joining that channel. But that can be a spot where you can go to just discuss things as you're working. Okay, as you go through the course, how does this work? Any questions there? I will monitor that and respond when I can. But it's also meant to be a place where you can talk to each other. In the current pandemic, it's a little bit hard to meet in a study group and work through homework problems together. So it's an additional tool that you can use to collaborate. Zoom, like I said, even pre-pandemic, I'll run Zoom, record all my lectures, and post them. Now I'm making that available, so at any time you can just log in and listen to the live stream instead of coming to class. Canvas for assignment submission. And then there's this other tool, Slido. A little bit less important if we're here in class, but if we are doing lectures remotely, Slido is just a way to anonymously ask questions or give feedback. So I have it open right now. It's a little bit cumbersome to do when I'm here. It's on my phone. But if you go to slido.com or slide.do, we get a page that looks like this, URL slide.do. And you can enter the event code ECE581. And then here, what it'll allow you to do is just type any kind of question or comment, and that'll come to me here on my phone. We go to online lectures, I'll be able to have that on a separate monitor. It's just a way that, you know, if you're here in class, so for just stop me and ask your question. But if you want to ask something anonymously, or if I'm rambling on about something and you can't find a moment to jump in, you can ask it there. It'll pop up on my phone and I can respond to those things. Okay. So a few tools we'll use. Get back, duplicate. Here's the links to all of them, and again, they're on the website. Zoom for lecture recording, Slack for collaboration between you and your peers, also for some communication between you all and me. Canvas for assignment submission, and Slido for kind of submitting any kind of questions anonymously if you'd like to. So office hours are gonna have to run a little bit differently since we're actually required to be in our office with our doors closed. In-person office hours aren't really possible. You could come kind of stand in the doorway and ask your questions, but most of the benefit of office hours is sitting down and writing things together. So we're gonna try to do those virtually. So those office hours that I mentioned are gonna be times where I will keep my schedule free at all times and be available to immediately start a telecon. We do that. Slack has integrated video conferencing, so we can just do it from Slack, or I can open Zoom or give you a call on a cell phone, whatever. But during those office hours, I'll keep my schedule free so that I can just respond to anything very quickly. Outside of office hours, you're welcome to email me, message me on Slack, anything, and then I'll, as soon as I can, set up a time to talk. Guarantee 24 hours, I'll try to do it as fast as I can. There's another component of this course traditionally that I'm at the moment not sure what we can do with. Okay, so past few times I've taught EC581, we've had what's called this tiny box challenge, which is a design competition where you design your own topology, select all the devices, build the actual circuit and test it, and meeting some required performance, the one who has the smallest and most efficient converter wins. Okay. So in 2016, we did 60 to 12, 60 watts. 2018, we did 48 to 1.2 at 12 watts. We would change that around, give a new application, but basically the here's the specs and what we're trying to build. Design it as you like. That usually starts after the first midterm and goes through the end of the semester. But it usually is working in groups of 2 to 3 and building and testing things together, which is gonna not be allowed due to social distancing. So this at the moment is TBD, what I'm gonna do to replace that. And we'll talk more about that by mid-semester. Like to be able to give you all that experience without making it an excessive amount of work. We say, just make it all individual and everybody has to design, build, and test their own converter in a couple of months. That's probably a little bit too much. With group work, you can't really do it together. So this is still TBD what's gonna be feasible in the current situation. Then the last thing here is I just wanted to hear from you and have some discussion on format and what you would like to do. So I listed this course as being in class, because if I don't get a classroom and I have no options. We're a relatively small group. Lecturing is not a lot of fun with a mask on. Having to go through all this is not a lot of fun for you guys. We could go online. Lecturing online is not a lot of fun. Taking a course online is not a lot of fun. So I'm open to your feedback. What would you guys like to do?
I personally get a lot more from the non-online version in class. I get have more real interaction because even with a computer, you're just less likely to interact. I mean, that's just my experience. Okay. To me, I feel like we get more out of it if we're in class.
Okay. Other people?
I concur.
Okay.
I think it's easier to ask questions when you're in person with someone versus like judging the speed of the lecture over online from past experiences.
Yeah. Like this Slido tool helps with that a little bit because you can just throw something up without having to interrupt, which I think helps. It's also anonymous, so you can, you know, ask a question however you like. The question is, why is this lecture so bad? It's anonymous, so you can do that. But I certainly agree. It's a different and better experience to be here in person. What I want to be respectful of is the situation and everybody's safety, particularly right now at the beginning of the semester. We're seeing cases spike here, at least for the next few weeks. I think there's some uncertainty about how safe it is to be here. So I'm willing to do whatever you guys want, subject to I'm not going to come in and lecture to one person. We have kind of at least four or five of us fine to come in and have the in-class lectures. It starts to be one or two people move it all online. Regardless of anything, I will continue live streaming the lectures and I will continue recording the lectures and posting them. If we're fully online, that'll be how you digest them. If we're in class, that's an additional resource. Other thoughts or comments? Okay, well, we'll continue at least through Friday. And I'll give you guys some time to think about it, monitor the situation, tell me if your thoughts change. At least Friday, we'll continue to come in here and lecture and ask you again. Okay. Any other comments or questions regarding layout and format before we start talking about an example problem?
The homework, do you accept to have the written or text?
So anything's fine. You're going to have to upload it to Canvas, so you'll have to scan it, but it's fine if it's just handwritten and scanned. Certainly not required to type anything up or do anything. It has to be clear enough that I can see what you were trying to do. Other than that, however's easiest for you. Okay, if nothing else, in kind of talking about a example problem to discuss this question of, okay, why are we talking about high frequency design in this course? And like I said previously, high frequency itself is always a bad thing. The pain, you don't want to do it. The reason you're sometimes forced to is to get towards goals that do matter in your design, things like reducing size, increasing control bandwidth, just a couple of example applications, a LED driver and a VRM. Looking at it, okay, what's the size constrained by? There's a little bit of MOSFET and control circuitry, a couple of resistors, but dominant things here are bulky capacitors, different passive elements, inductors and EMI filters and other things. And if we can go up to higher frequency to reduce the ripple and therefore reduce the size of those components, potentially an advantageous thing. Okay. Applications like voltage regulators, things that would power microprocessors, CPUs. Ripple can be extremely important. Faster we can control and the more we can keep the output voltage very well regulated, the better for sensitive electronic loads. Okay. So if we want to do this kind of thing, what sorts of components and concepts are we going to play with? Well, get there by looking at using different devices, using different topologies, switching converters, passive element design, and control techniques or modulation that we switch differently. In this course, our focus is really going to be kind of here. Since this is a power electronics theory course, detailed implementation of passives, we won't get into it. We'll have some discussion of that as we go along. But most of the focus of 581 is going to be kind of here.
The passives means capacitor and transformer inductor.
Right, magnetics and capacitive elements. Yeah. Okay. So most of our focus will be somewhere up here. Okay. So kind of look at extending from fundamental theory of power electronics in something like 481. I'm gonna go through an example converter design. And the slide is just talking about why the design of it's a reasonable thing. So it's gonna be a 12 to 48 volt converter. One such application that's kind of up and coming, gaining a lot of popularity is 48 volt low voltage distribution in electric vehicles. So most gasoline vehicles historically have a 12 volt bus backed by a lead acid battery. As we are continuing to electrify vehicles, not necessarily going to full electric drivetrain, but just putting a whole lot more microprocessors everywhere, trying to increase efficiency by things like putting a start stop on the engine, an electric machine to shut down the engine when you're at a stoplight and start it back up so you're not wasting fuel. All these things, this 12 volt bus, modern cars may have 3 kilowatts of power on it, which means it's got hundreds of amps flowing through that bus. Then you got big problems with wiring, getting really thick and heavy cables to keep the losses down on the 12 volt bus. So one solution that's gaining traction as kind of an intermediary between a full electric vehicle, you know, a Tesla, and a gasoline vehicle, they call it mild hybrid, where you have an additional 48 volt bus beyond the 12 volt bus, and then pull off some of your higher power loads on this low voltage system and put them on that 48 volt bus, like start generator, turbos, superchargers, some of the mechanically actuated systems, HVAC, also if you're going towards autonomous driving, things like the LiDAR and radar systems might be on this 48 volt bus, acted by a 48 volt higher voltage lithium ion battery.
Why the vehicle battery?
Why the
voltage is 48? Are there any specific reason for that?
So, why 48? Short answer is, so if you go above about 54, it's a shock hazard. The 48 is as high as you want to comfortably go while it being safe for like a mechanic to go and access it. Okay. So 54 is when it starts to need to have requirements for safety and shielding, can't be touched because it's a shock hazard. This is about as high as you can go before you have to start dealing with fully enclosing anything that has that voltage on it. And so you could go a little bit higher, but then you'd have to maintain the ripple to make sure it doesn't go up. So with 48, you've got a little bit of range there to stay under the shock hazard. So it's higher, but not so high. You know, if you have a full electric vehicle, you got a 400 volt system, but everything there needs to be shielded and safe. Anything that could be accessed by a mechanic or anybody else.
Oh, Tesla. Tesla has been electric vehicle. The DC bus for the motor driver, motor drive, it can be all hyperlinks.
Mm. And so this is this intermediate step, right? So it can be the vehicle, is it 400 volt batteries? There's lots of people looking at going to like 800 volts and higher for the motor drive, whether building the battery there or putting a DC to DC in between. So if you're actually doing traction operation, you need that higher voltage to be minimum tens, maybe hundreds of kilowatts for the actual drive. This is saying, okay, it's still a gasoline engine. All the traction power is still coming from gas. All we're doing is trying to make some of these ancillary components more efficient. The starter is electric, but you know, can we make it a little bit more efficient at a higher voltage? Some of the control systems, some of the higher power things that are currently on the 12 volt bus, can we get more efficient by pushing them up here? No car-sized vehicle would put, you know, motor drive on 48. It has to be much higher. But when you do that, you have all the safety concerns and other things associated with the high voltage.
Little question. Why is there a battery on the 12 volt port map as well as on the 48 volt?
Yeah, mostly because you don't want to have to design this thing to process full power, right? So some of these things, your starter or generator, may have, you know, average almost zero power, but peak 500 amps being pulled by this, and you don't have to process that through here. Same thing down here. So it's part to stabilize the bus and part to make the design of this thing only have to address average power. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, from here on, this is going to be kind of irrelevant to what we talk about, but I'm going to talk about a 12 to 48 volt converter. I just wanted to give you an example where that would actually be a useful thing to have, where those voltages might come into play. Okay, so we're going to look at this thing. We're going to design it as just a unidirectional boost and for much lower power, perhaps it's a modular system. But I'm going to look at just a 12 to 48 output resistance of 48 ohms, required output ripple of 0.1 volts. So output power here, V out squared over R, 48 squared over 48 is 48 watts. Not enough for that application, but maybe we put many of these in parallel. Okay. And so I need to design something that can do this for these specs. And since I maybe don't have the time or don't want to put in the effort to design it, I'm just going to let somebody else do it for me. So I went to TI Webbench, plugged in my specs, and it spit out, okay, here's your converter. All right, so that's what this is. They give me back something that I don't know the internals of this tool, but they think is a good design for it. The only thing we can say for sure is it is biased towards using TI parts wherever it can. Tell me, they buy all our parts, and you can build this thing. Okay. Some details of what it spat out for me. Pick some inductor. The inductor is 22 microhenries and about 2 milliohms of equivalent series resistance. This is a boost converter. Only potentially confusing thing is it's got a couple of FETs in parallel for the transistor. Just puts two of the same thing in parallel to try to get the on resistance down on it. These two transistors are 10 milliohms devices. And some partner we picked out. Got a diode to put a 22 microfarad output capacitor. Size that up high enough in order to be able to meet the ripple specification of 0.1 ohms. The main boost power stage, output capacitor, diode, FETs, inductor. This is all a closed loop controller. Picked out some IC specifically designed to do boost output voltage controls and feedback the output voltage. That's an error ring required internally in order to change the duty cycle to regulate. Okay. All this stuff just has to do with control and kind of startup and operation. Okay, so there's my design, and I want to look into it and say, okay, is this a good design? It also selected a switching frequency of 202 kilohertz and has a predicted efficiency of 93%, which is not bad for something that I didn't have to put any effort into. Just typed in the specs and got a design back. So we'll kind of use that as our starting point. And I want to look into the operation of this design and see if there's anything I can improve. So first thing I did is I just put it over an LT spice, found a FETs, a diode, did an inductor with the same inductance and same equivalent series resistance, ran a simulation. In simulation, I get 93.9%, actually even better than what it predicted I was going to get. Some of that may be control losses, since I didn't put in that whole controller. I just put in a gate driver, takes a duty cycle at the input.
I have a question.
Sure.
So there is no loss in the inductor and capacitor?
So there is loss in both. In this case, they're inside that element in LT spikes. You open up the inductor, you can say equivalent series resistance. So I put the same 2 milliohms from the previous slide. Okay. Output capacitor, I put this 0.8 ohms. But same thing here, it's not going to be a significant loss element. So here's my basic boost converter. As long as I keep everything ideal in simulation, use two FETs in parallel, just act like one FET with half the resistance. Since their gates and sources and drains are all directed shorted together, they're always going to switch the same match. Efficiency is a little higher, and I expect that from background you could kind of go through and sketch out things like these basic waveforms for the boost converter, or your one-type analysis, do things like, say I'll take the volt-second balance on the inductor, tell me average voltage on the inductor, which is VG minus V prime V out is equal to zero. Tells me that D prime is equal to VG over V out, or D is equal to V over V out, 12 over 48 and a quarter, so D is 3/4. My ideal duty cycle, running with 75% of the time the transistor is on, 25% the diode is on within any one period. Could go through and solve, hey, if that's true, before my output voltage is 48, my load is 48 ohms. Look at V out squared over R. Tell me that I'm going to get 48 watts of output power. Then assuming 94% is close enough to 100%, I could say at the input I have that same 48 watts from my 12 volt source. It's going to tell me IL is about 4 amps. My average output current is about 1 amp. Okay. Then if I wanted to get a little bit finer integrity on the waveforms that I'm predicting out of this thing, I do things like calculate the ripple. So if I wanted to calculate delta IL, the inductor current ripple, the difference here in IL waveform. Label these a little bigger. It's the diode current, the drain to source MOSFET current. This is the voltage on the inductor. I wanted to calculate that delta IL, I'd say, okay, this is 2 delta IL, excuse me. We define delta IL in 481 type analysis as the difference between the average value and the peak or min. So if this is my 4 amps IL, this is delta IL. So then the total amount that the inductor current rises in either DTS or D prime TS is twice that. So then delta IL is 1/2 times however much the inductor current rose. Take the first interval, VG over L times DTS. If I plug in all the numbers, 22 microhenry inductor, 3/4 D. DS is 1 over 202 kilohertz. It's something like 2 amps. Predicted current ripple. Okay. So if I do all that, this is kind of where I would get with my 481 analysis. I could sketch out these waveforms and then begin to calculate losses from them. Right. So should all be reviewed. Hopefully that's something that everybody could do. No problem at this point. Get to here. So let's run the simulation and see what we get. I'm 3.9%, so it must be operating pretty close to ideal. So here's some waveforms from this LTSPICE simulation. I've in red, the diode current, this kind of bluish color is the MOSFET drain to source current. I'm summing up both of the two MOSFETs that are in parallel, so I can get what would be the equivalent drain to source current if it was one device. I got the output voltage, switch node voltage, which would generally be the midpoint of our two switching devices. We'll call this V switch. In purple here in the middle, inductor current, gray. And then I'm down at the bottom, I have the output power instantaneous and the input power, the out and the in. Multiplying input voltage times inductor current, output voltage times the resistor current to get those two powers. So what do I see here? It looks more or less like I predicted. The inductor current on this right axis is about 4 amps average, about 1 amp in either direction. Be my 2 amps of total ripple. Got a nice triangular waveform. My drain to source current and my diode current look like these kind of trapezoidal pulses where they just follow the inductor current whenever that device is on. Here I can get where that efficiency number came from. Was, keep in mind when you're using LTSPICE, you need to average over some integer number of switching periods. But if I average my P out and my P in over some N times TS, you can see here on my waveform, I've got exactly 5 periods. Something that a lot of people make mistakes on at some point. If you don't have a full period at the end here, your average will get thrown off. For example, if I stopped right here, my average of Pn will be a little bit high because I get this part integral under this curve in my average, but not this to bring it back down. Okay. I averaged over 5 periods where I got my efficiency of 93.9%. Okay, all looks pretty good. All pretty well explained by our basic theory. Anything that's not, anything that looks bad to you? Yeah.
Can you go back to the last slide real quick?
Sure.
I think your calculations of delta IL is correct. I did it and I got the lineup.
Should be. You're right. 2 amps is 2 delta IL. So this here is 2 amps, 1 amp here.
I noticed that one, you showed the simulation graph in there with the proxy.
Yeah. You're right. Okay. So, are we happy? Do we understand everything going on in this design? About whatever the heck is going on right here. This point in every period, waveform seems to suddenly spike off the screen. Compared to kind of my ideal waveform, which would just be this little trapezoidal pulse, here I'm seeing this point where the diode shuts off, MOSFET turns on. My diode current is going negative off the screen. My MOSFET current is going positive off the screen. Let me zoom in on that and see what actually is going on in this spike. zoom in on the spike, showing some of the same waveforms. Again, my drain to source current, my diode current, switch node voltage. This is just VGS of the two MOSFETs to show when they're supposed to turn on. And then down here, I'm looking at instantaneous power on the two devices. So the switch come out, voltage between the switch node and the output times the diode current is the instantaneous power dissipation on the diode. It's the instantaneous power dissipation in the MOSFET. So, heck's going on. First thing is some gigantic current. I've got a 4 amps input, 1 amp output converter, and I'm seeing this current spike up to 500 amps going through the MOSFET, minus 500 amps going through the diode. This lasts a total here of about 0.8 nanoseconds. So it's very brief, but massive. So what's going on here? Any thoughts?
Diode reverse recovery.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so we look at the diode current. The diode current starts out, go back to the previous slide to even see, the current should be about 3 amps as we go into this spike. Somewhere 3 amps here that you can't even see on the axes, and then it goes down to about minus 400-ish amps. First thing is diode negative current. That's not supposed to be a thing, right? Diode's job is to keep positive current. But the first recovery is a transient phenomenon where we do need negative current to shut the diode off. Okay, so let's go through this a little bit and just see what's happening here. This point, VGS goes high. So this is the time when our controller is telling the MOSFET to turn on. And ideally, right at this time, MOSFET would turn on, take over all the inductor current. Switch node voltage would drop instantaneously down to zero. The MOSFET is now shorting out the switch node. Diode current would drop to zero. MOSFET current would go to IL. And the whole transition would take place here. Okay, real system, real devices, VGS goes high, then we have first thing, just some delay where really nothing's happening. We got some time delay for turn on. Here, internally, we've taken the external VGS high, but kind of the internal channel hasn't developed, the MOSFET's not really on yet. Okay. That takes us up until here when we actually start to see the MOSFET drain the source voltage drop. Okay. Something's actually happening here. So the switching transition actually begins in the power stage. What happens? Well, the diode is on, conducting 3 amps. The MOSFET begins to turn on, but the diode is still locked on. The diode is still conducting. Kind of from here until about this point, both the MOSFET and the diode are on. MOSFET has gone into saturation, the diode is still forward bias. Both of them are conducting, and we've got essentially a somewhat resistive short of the output capacitor. Both of these devices are on. And we're seeing a very large current develop, shorting out this output capacitor. A bunch of current going backwards through the diode, is it still on down through the MOSFET, closing in this loop. The amount of current developed there is limited only by the impedance going through this. Diode being on, MOSFET being on, both relatively small resistances, so we can develop a whole lot of current there. Okay. And this continues until we put enough negative current through the diode to pull out all of its stored charge and allow it to shut off. So somewhere here at this point, all of that stored minority carrier charge inside the diode has been pulled out, and we're able to actually shut the diode off. So here is where the diode becomes a reverse biased. That point, then, we've got this huge negative current, diode shuts off. There's still a capacitive pathway to flow current through it. You can kind of snap down, drop this switch node voltage, and get the MOSFET fully on. From here, this is the end of the switching transition. Now the MOSFET's fully on, the diode's fully off, and we're just in the DTS interval. So, what's the net impact of this? Doesn't look good, right? Probably some EMI concerns, maybe some component rating concerns, thermal heating, does it damage it? Assuming it all works and we can actually use it in the application. Main impact is, okay, how much is this hurting us in terms of losses? So down here at the bottom, just during this interval, calculating the instantaneous power on these two devices, and these blue and green numbers are the integral of this waveform. We've got 5.8 microjoules of energy that ends up getting lost in the MOSFET, 1.3 microjoules in the diode. Sum those two up, we have about 7 microjoules of total energy. Wrote E on here. Energy that's just lost in the turn-on process of the transistor. That happens every time I turn on the transistor in steady state. So I've got a total power loss associated with it, which is just that energy times FS. And that is about 1.5 watts. Okay. 1.5 watts in a 48 watt output converter is about 3% of the total loss, 3% of the total power. 1.5 over 48, 3% of my power is going towards just this loss. And I had a 94% efficient converter, and 6% of my power is going to loss, and 3% of it is just this. About half my losses are just this diode reverse recovery and its impact during turn on. So there is a clear candidate for improving this thing, right? If I could do something about this reverse recovery, I could cut my losses in half and go from 94% up to 97% efficiency. Get rid of all of this. Okay. How can we do that? Well, first, let's just kind of cover this. Well, what time do we end? 10:05? Is that right? 10:05. Okay. I think I'm out of time, actually, then. So we'll talk a little bit about diode reverse recovery, about minority and majority carrier devices, which kind of ones you prefer for different applications, and then talk about some ways to get rid of this reverse recovery problem, what you're left with in terms of switching loss, and then how to get rid of that. Kind of work through and try to improve our design until it becomes so good that we could never possibly actually build it and make it work. All right, so we'll pick up Friday. See you then.
Are there any price value capture we can read?
No, there is. There will never be assigned readings for this class since the book is not required. Everything will be what's covered in lecture and any of the supplemental notes. For now, if you, this, like I said, is just an introductory example. Moving through it fairly quickly. If you want to go back and look at this reverse recovery effect, that is covered in the earlier chapters of the Fundamentals of Power Electronics book. But the conclusion here is going to be, for the kind of converters we're going to talk about in this class, this better not be something you're allowing to happen. Okay. So This is all just review. Fine if you don't understand it in a lot of detail.
Your slides came online.
Yeah. So my slides, all of it will be on the course website shortly after class. I'll post this with all the annotations, and the recording of the lecture will be online. Thanks, everyone.